Friday afternoon deploy was cherry-picked from a declined pull request to Kubernetes. And I'm glad to be having these arguments with
you. Well, it's fun to explore these paradigms because, I mean, a part of my brain handles Q&A on you know, what I write and stuff. And so I think these things. Of course, I would want it to do everything and make me a sandwich, too. But, you know.
You're thinking QA, not Q&A. Although I do Q&A in my head also.
That's true. With a rubber ducky that I have in my brain.
Oh, man. Rubber ducky.
So I had... I've got two rubber duck debugging related stories that are pretty fun. I had a friend that worked for a telco in Indianapolis, and the director of engineering had a cardboard cutout of Kobe Bryant in the main room. And if you came and asked him a question, he would say, "Have you asked Kobe first?" And they'd be like, "No." And he's like, "You have to ask Kobe first." And like they'd inevitably get mad and storm off, and they'd go stand by Kobe Bryant and start talking, and you just hear him be like, "Ah, crap!" And then they'd go back to their desk and they'd have solved the problem because they had talked it through for a moment.
That's so funny.
And then I had a rubber ducky. I have a rubber ducky here. When I worked for Daisy, I thought, rubber ducky on the desk. That, like, originally I was like, "Oh, I'll upgrade." And then I wanted like a Trigun figure. Uh-huh. Because Trigun's my favorite anime, and
it's one of the few that I've actually watched.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
No context.
So I wanted Wolfwood, I was like, "Oh, going from a rubber ducky to an anime figure in this context isn't going to help things." So I actually got a John Wayne figure of John T. Chance from Real Bravo that I had on my desk. And when I was having problems,
that's badass.
I would ask the Duke. I'd be like, "Why is this server not running right?" And I would like go through it, and I would rubber duck with John Wayne.
Did he speak in John Wayne's like voice in your head?
"Well, Pilgrim, you shouldn't be using IIS. That's a mandate from up top, John. I know this."
It's nice. I have a Tyrion Lannister on my desk. That's my rubber ducky in between my 3D printed Gandalf.
Yeah,
it's always good to ask Gandalf.
I don't have one. I don't have any desk figures. I don't know that I ever did. I can't think of one in the past, but. Someone else used to have, they don't work here anymore. One of our former engineers also had a rubber ducky on their desk, and I always appreciated that it was there. So I wonder, you know, if everyone's hung over or not. By the time you listen to this, it will be after the New Year's holiday. So
that would be a substantial amount of drinking to make it to a Friday from a Monday night.
We don't have the luxury. I haven't, I don't think, in my career. Some people take like the entire week, like 2 weeks off for the holidays.
Yeah, that's true.
Can keep going.
That's true.
So this would make, this our first podcast episode of 2019.
Yeah. Excellent. Welcome to 2019.
Yes.
Yes.
It's good to be here.
It's, yeah. I suppose we attempt to predict the future.
Yes. Hopefully I'm still here.
Yeah. So we thought it would be fun, for this episode. I don't remember where I was reading it a couple of days ago. It was on some, you know, how does micro framework blog post, actually written by, Alibaba Cloud, which is like the AWS of the Eastern world.
Right.
And they're becoming like quite enormous actually out there. And, they were mentioning this, Python micro framework for API development called Falcon. And I was just like, what? This, how did this pass me by? I've never heard of it. And it, you know, it's been around for a couple of years. The post that I was reading was written in 2017. I was like, I have not heard of this framework. So I started digging into it and it looked pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of sent it to some folks on the team, our Python people, and were like, hey, have you seen this? And Alan, you had seen it before.
I'd seen it
at some
point.
But we all got to talking about different frameworks, different specifically Python frameworks for API development and our preferences and what we like and don't like and why would you do one over the other. And so we thought, well, hey, let's just do an episode on that. Let's talk about our experiences and the ones that we've used and haven't and what's good and what's bad.
Yeah. You know, and we can expand upon, you know, a little bit beyond Python frameworks.
Even. I think it's worth it to do. I mean, one of the things that when I was looking at Falcon, I was looking at some of the benchmarks they published. Mm-hmm. And like any framework, I won't say any, but most of the time when a framework publishes its own benchmarks, it's like through some framework colored glasses, you know?
Yeah. There's this one. What is that?
So like the Falcon benchmarks are all comparing it to other Python frameworks. And then it kind of gives itself a huge advantage because Falcon can be compiled with Cython or can be run on PyPy, where it like kills the other Python frameworks. But it's only comparing itself to Python frameworks. So it's worthwhile mentioning, you know, what else is out there in other languages, especially from a performance perspective, because beating all the other Python frameworks, while is a feat in the grand scheme of like efficient computing, probably not that big of a story.
Yeah.
But great to write, you know?
Yeah, totally. And that, you know, I mean, Python has, you know, you trade things for being able to use an interpreted language that you can interact with while you're writing code. You don't have to wait to compile. You can do it right there in the console. Does this work?
Yep.
You know?
Developer happiness goes a long way, right?
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Production speed and all that is you know, exponential compared to if we had to do everything that we do in C or assembly. Mm-hmm. Imagine that.
And hardware is cheap, right? We can scale horizontally now. We can make up for throughput, you know. I was talking to a group that came in the other day, kind of pitching an idea for building a web service for them, and they kind of were concerned a little bit about Python's throughput and, you know, compared to compiled languages. And that was like what I told him. I was like, you know, throughput is really kind of two-dimensional. One dimension is the speed of the actual application, the code itself. And if you can scale that up, obviously you can have higher throughput. But then there's also horizontal scaling, which is how much concurrency can you have at the same time. Mm-hmm. In an ideal world, you scale both numbers and you get the most dramatic impact on your throughput. But scaling speed can only get you so far before you have to go horizontally as well, which is, I think, where Python rocks, right? And just all of the DevOps tooling and things like that to go horizontal with it. And you can get it pretty fast with things like Cython and PyPy and what do we use on MondaBrain? Noomba. Mm-hmm. You know, just-in-time compiler to LLVM.
Mm-hmm.
It's not C fast, but it's approaching that. It's like,
you know, it's that compromise between the two.
It's within that order of magnitude, you know, mm-hmm. of speed, which is pretty awesome.
But yet you're still not having to write it in C, you know, that's the trade-off.
That's the blessing.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So you kind of get the best of both worlds then.
That was the biggest knock when I was getting into Rails. When Rails was really blowing up, the biggest knock on Rails was Rails doesn't scale. Like Rails is really nice when you're building smaller things, but you can't make anything huge in production with it. And it's just one of those things where the way we scale changed in such a way that you don't have that problem. Like it's not an issue in the same way anymore. Like I remember I was blown away when I found out that Strava, the running app, is just a big old Rails app.
Is it still Rails?
Mm-hmm. Still Rails. I met one of the developers at Strange Loop, and I was just like, "You're kidding me! That's a Rails app." I was like, "Yeah." I was just like, "Oh, that's awesome! I'm gonna not pick fun at it for being a Rails app." Because I enjoy Rails, but I had always kind of just I had never made a Rails app that scaled that big, so I had just kind of like given up on the fact that Rails can handle some huge production stuff. And I was just like, okay, well, I accept that Rails doesn't scale. So I was like, I'm not going to be on a product that big. So I was fine with it, and then moved on to Django, which would have the same issues that
people say the same
Rails has
for the same reason,
right? Exactly.
Interpreted language, and you know, you can say at some point, certainly no longer true, just because of the scale and post Facebook acquisition, but Instagram was built in Django as well as Pinterest, and those are big enough now that now they're built in everything under the sun, every component of it. And I don't know the internals of Strava well. But I would imagine that there's still, you know, like Strava does stuff where it does like post, like after you track a run or a ride, it does some post analysis on effort and it does some cool mapping stuff. Mm. Some of those may be kicked out to side services that are implemented in Rails. Rails probably can scale pretty good at delivering markup. You know what I mean? Because that's what you need to do. If you're just delivering markup and you have side processing or other async services that can kind of fill in, plug the holes. I mean, you can make anything do a lot. Shit, people still write apps in PHP.
Yeah, Facebook's, at least it's probably, who knows what it is now besides just like pure evil. But it's...
pure concentrated evil wielded to render HTML.
But it was, ironically, on that note, all built in PHP originally. So it transitioned well from PHP to evil.
You know, so I think whatever language you're using, you know, you kind of have that baseline of like, okay, I'm going to build a web app. And so, you know, in my world, I think, okay, Django, that'll handle authentication. And, you know, I got an ORM to interact with my database and all that and everything. So I can get that far. But then sometimes you have some specialized services that you need to do. And so then I think microservices is the right answer to that. And that kind of, you know, is where sometimes we branch out and look at micro frameworks. And that's where I'd found Falcon. I was just looking at, you know, alternatives out there, what all is out there.
Right.
I think I actually got down that rabbit hole listening to a different podcast, and they were talking about API Star that Tom Christie had done. And so I was like, oh, what's this? What's Tom doing these days? What happened to don't leave DRF, you know? So
unless he's leaving it so that Django takes it on his core. Django needs to take DRF on his core, and you can quote me on that.
Oh yeah, well, I think we talked about that.
I'll say it again.
I hadn't considered whether or not that might be strategic.
He just needs to orphan it enough to where Django just puts it up here on the shelf.
Sure do hope someone takes care of that. You know,
yeah,
someone maybe with namesake rights, perhaps.
Because API Star, whenever I first tested it, was compatible with Django. So it was very similar to
compatible to in what way?
Like you could plug the Django ORM and stuff like that.
And I guess you could probably use API Star's serializers.
So you could just use a piece of the Django ORM, like just the Django ORM, in the same way that you can do that with like Active Record with Rails and stuff.
Yeah.
Active Directory. I always get those backwards.
Active Directory.
It was the
Active
first one. Yeah. Active Directory is Windows. Like,
oh yeah,
I am users. Yeah,
That's where authentication goes to die.
Yeah. I've changed in my IT experience. I've changed many a password for folks in Active Directory.
I don't know how many times that we've been tasked at some point or another with implementing like LDAP. In Django, and. It's really telling at how dated of a practice that is that you can't find. There are libraries out there, like several for LDAP and like with the other federated services. I forget what they all are.
I get that. But I get that.
They're all Python 2. And so it's like, see, no one's done this shit in 6 years. Stop asking.
Right. I get that with some of the API work I'm doing right now with some of the systems. They're just like, ODBC. And I'm just like, don't even say those letters to me.
Yeah, we had to do that. In a project earlier this year that we had to use ODBC drivers to, when we talking to Microsoft SQL database. Yeah, it actually wasn't terrible with Django. We had to use a third-party app. It was actually installing the ODBC drivers on Ubuntu. The host that we were using was by far the hardest part, but actually we got it to plug pretty nicely into Django's ORM. I was kind of impressed with it.
You talk to me about that later.
Yeah, it was. I've got some notes on that.
I forgot about that. Yeah.
Yep.
So, you know, Falcon looks cool. I don't know about like what it's like to serialize stuff in there.
I had every intention of actually building a Hello World in this before we started recording the podcast.
I will at some point.
It's Friday and it's a holiday and I didn't make it there, but I did get far enough that I had read through the documentation. And I was ready to start writing code, and it looks really straightforward, not unlike Flask as far as the amount of code it would take to write Hello World and Falcon looked comparable to what you might see in Flask.
Yeah.
Less code than API Star. API Star is more verbose, but way fucking less code than DRF.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the benchmark that I want. Okay. I get it. It's faster. You can compile with Cython. I'm a little bit more concerned with how quickly can I spin up a microservice?
Yeah.
Like in like the amount of
dev
code
time.
Right?
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. And it, it looks to, at least looks at surface value. To score pretty highly in that regard. That's my biggest complaint about DRF. You get all the batteries included, but somehow with all those batteries included, you have to write a shitload of code to stand up an authenticated API endpoint.
Well, one thing that drives me nuts is the cores not being
we
enabled
talking
right
about
away.
Yeah.
You know, which in API Star is just like, no, yeah, let everything happen. You know, but I mean, I don't know. And that may be because it's targeted, you know, DRF works in tandem with Django and isn't necessarily intended to be a micro framework that
I mean,
you know.
Django certainly predates that paradigm, right? Mm-hmm. But it's still, I get why Django doesn't support cross-origin resource sharing by default.
Mm-hmm.
I don't get why REST framework requires that degree of config.
You know, and so on their documentation, they have that third-party solution to it on
Django cores headers is what it's called, which
that's,
is actually that, not
that's what I was trying to remember.
It's actually not a DRF or it's not a DRF package. That's that's a generic Django package, so that adds some headers to Django's like request middleware.
Otto, I don't even want to butcher his last name or whatever, but this guy, every time I click on that to go and set up cores in DRF, I always have a little like panic moment and also like, oh, just bless you, sir, for doing this thing and please maintain it forever.
But when you click on his library,
yeah,
because like we have a lot of APIs out there that depend on it,
and I mean he's got like almost 3,000 stars, so we're not the only ones. So that's good. I'm sure somebody would pick up that torch, you know, if they had to.
Remind note to self when I'm writing the show notes, fork that bad boy.
Yeah.
No
kidding.
Yeah.
I saw that you also posted this link in our Slack channel.
Did you see the benchmarks?
Of the benchmarks.
Right. So that's the benchmarks that I look at and I'm always talking about. So those aren't, that's, you know, those are like, I'm not sure who Tech Empower is, honestly, but
yeah,
they don't seem to be affiliated with these different frameworks,
well,
right?
Well, so, I remember looking, I've looked at this list of frameworks before. This is the Tech Empower Web Framework Benchmarks.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't looked at them in a while. I remember personally feeling like the test methodology was a little weak on this, or a little contrived. But God, they test so many frameworks, you know.
And they have different kinds of tests. So usually the one that I look at is like JSON serialization.
Right.
And so if, like right now, my choice, if I needed a fast microservice, I'm looking at Gen in Go, honestly.
Okay. Yep.
If you do a search on there, I mean, that's the 100th one down.
So there's 100 things faster than Gen? I haven't heard of, I mean, most of this stuff that's scoring really high, which is like, That's kind of what I think of, kind of what I worry about with the methodology, is that there are 100 things faster than that.
Mm-hmm.
No one's using any of them.
Yeah.
And it's like, these are frameworks engineered around making benchmarks, right?
Right. Like, so
this is fucking MongoDB.
So one at the top, 49 is ULib MongoDB.
Yeah. There you go.
One, there was one at the top a few years ago. It looks like, so they did one for this year and I haven't looked at it in a while, but there was one at the top that was, it was a C library.
Is it H2O? H2O?
Fast HTTP, I think is what it is.
I don't see
God, that looked like a pain though to try and, you know, to get that working. Because then I was intrigued of like, what? There's a micro framework out there for C and C++? Like, what's that like? And then, yeah, not as much documentation out there for that as there is Django and all that and Flask, you know. Of course.
A lot of rust on this list.
There is, right? There's some Scala in there too.
There's a lot of rust going on, and that's pretty interesting. And there's like, I don't know enough on this to speak intelligently, so I'm going to bring it up and then let it die unless you guys know more of it. But a lot of stuff going on with Rust and Firefox. And like the team at Mozilla is really pushing that. And I don't know if that is around like Rust engines that run in the browser, or if that's like rendering engines under Firefox. But Rust is really cool. It's a really interesting language. Ryan Hebert gave a couple talks on it actually at FayettePy. Because there were a lot of really easy similarities to draw between Rust and Python. Mm. And he could, you know, Python was a convenient scapegoat to compare a compiled language against it and just like obliterate it in a contrived benchmark.
Sure.
But it was still really interesting. Mm-hmm. I thought it was neat. So I always take benchmarks with a grain of salt.
Oh, definitely.
But obviously, like looking at this list of, I'm looking at the JSON serialization benchmarks now.
Yeah.
You know, comparing Python frameworks to non-Python frameworks is obviously there are going to be some, you know, serious performance differences between this and shit written in C. But who wants to serialize JSON in C except for Alan?
Well, yeah.
Who spent how many weeks of this year serializing JSON in C?
You know, I tried to not quantify the actual time involved, but it was hours.
Yeah.
That's for sure. So,
some number of hours more than one.
Yeah. And, so I just, you know, that was a notch to put on my, you know, whatever I put my coding notches on.
Your war belt.
Yes.
Of coding.
Yeah. I was thinking my war sash that like,
goes in your club, like, from Gangs of New York.
Oh, that's the one. Yes. The tally marks on it. That's what I was thinking of. Yeah.
I have good news. Django is 271 and Rails is 279. So there's that.
Neck and neck, but outpacing it.
Yeah.
Okay.
So where's Flask at on there?
Yeah. Where's Flask?
274. So Django beats Flask.
Yeah.
In benchmarking.
Okay. That's interesting. Yeah. Which benchmark is that you're looking at?
JSON serialization, right?
I think it's just overall. Let me see.
Or is it the
best? I'm saying dumb things now. It sounds
so there's a bar across the top there. Link that Alan posted Fortunes. Was Fortunes. I don't know what that is.
I don't know what that is either.
Yeah.
So JSON serialization.
Come on now.
If you click
you
on
me
that.
To the wrong place.
Sorry. I thought you could navigate it.
Now I sound foolish in front of the world.
It really depends on, I mean, because they're totally different. These lists totally shift in different directions.
Django is still ahead of Flask on JSON serialization.
Yeah, it's 195, specifically using Python 3, too.
Is that Django or is that DRF?
It's Django.
Just Django. So DRF, I don't know if it's faster.
I don't know if they're including that, though, right?
Yeah.
Django REST. Yeah, it's not, do they call it REST framework?
That would be a little
it's not
vague,
on here. So,
a little vague for this list.
So I don't know. You know, that's interesting. Because I mean,
you would have to, because otherwise you're hand rolling that. Like that has to include.
Just about. It has a JSON serializer. It just doesn't do dates
datetime
fields.
Well, no, there's actually there's like JSON model serialization in Django models, but it's really, really, it's not robust. And so I wouldn't be surprised if from a performance perspective, it outperforms REST framework. Because it doesn't do nearly the
right. It's
of
not
stuff
functionally
that
complete,
right?
But
it's
yeah,
like calling dot dict on a
pretty
model
much
and,
right.
And then JSON. Yeah,
that's what it's doing. it's converting a model to a dictionary, and then it's calling JSON dot dump string, and then like using some default handler to handle some more complex types than just like integers and strings. But yeah, it's pretty rudimentary. But that's interesting. Is Flask in the list?
Yeah.
Find that where
it's right below Django.
Oh, it's below Django.
Yeah.
That makes me feel
so still well. It still outperforms Django by these benchmarks.
You know what outperforms both of those, it looks like, is Sinatra, which is like the Flask of Rubyland.
Yeah.
Right?
Sinatra's really nice. It's kind of the go-to, I need something lighter than Rails. It would be the Flask, I would think.
The micro
Flask equivalent.
Yeah. Micro framework. So. That's kind of how Gen is. There's another one out there that I know does like template rendering and stuff in Go and everything. But Gen, I've set up a toy CRUD application in that with a React front end. So
API Star, your personal kind of I don't know if it's your favorite, Alan, but it's your kind of pet project, maybe.
I like it all right. I'm keeping my eye on it for sure.
It's way up at 120.
Yeah.
Ahead of Falcon.
Yep, exactly. Ahead of Falcon. That's why I wanted to bring up, and that's when,
I went down that hole. No. Falcon's
my horse beats your horse.
Falcon's at 111 on Jason's serialization.
Yeah.
Falcon's got it.
Oh, I'm thinking Falcon Pi 3 is slower than Falcon.
That's probably because you're talking about, this may be Cython optimized Falcon.
Oh, I bet.
PyPy Falcon. So that's one of the tricks up its sleeve, which honestly, I mean, it's a fair trick. I'm sure that you could like use something like Numba to optimize API Star, but you have to do it in the core library. Like having someone already do all of the annotation and typesetting, typecasting, not typesetting. That's something else. That's what Gutenberg would do. Everything that you need to have it compiled to Cython in the core framework itself is a pretty huge advantage.
It is. For optimizing. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, totally.
But that's interesting. But again, okay, raw benchmarks. Mm-hmm. I'm skeptical of those. Developer happiness.
Well, in the scale of this thing, that's Falcon's 111, API Star's 120. I mean, so
they're pretty
close
there.
What kind of a difference would you notice there?
I'll say this. I've written an API. Because it's 2019 now. Your tech blog has to have blockchain in it. And so I wrote a totally rudimentary, stupid blockchain.
I remember this.
Service and API Star. So I have built an API with it that actually does some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
In my reading of Falcon documentation and kind of thinking about that project, it would be less code to write in Falcon.
Mm.
It seems to be more straightforward. API Star is cool, but you've got their serialization framework where you define your data types.
And that's kind of the paradigm that it's taking off with is, so the idea, to my understanding, behind API Star is to capitalize on benefits and additions to Python 3 that, you know, it just, I guess, makes sense to basically start a new framework with that in mind. So,
namely, but very high on that list is the type hinting system, right?
Exactly. And so it takes advantage of that, and that's how it does its serialization, which I imagine is kind of how it can do it faster than probably DRF, instead of however DRF's doing it, it's, you know, doing some asserts against whatever type hinting is on whatever the fields are. And that's how you do the validation and everything like that. So you create this type class, and that's basically your serializer class. And then that represents your data model.
Yep. And you describe the fields as types.
Yep.
And so that gives, it gives a syntactically interesting way to define that.
Totally,
I don't know that gives any sort of actual performance boost. It gives a stability boost, right?
Yeah.
Because it can be validated.
And
it's not compiled, but it can be tested.
Another great thing on top of that, by using the type system like that, the type hinting, you get like documentation for your API, like out of the box.
Yeah. And it uses I can see here that API Star like has a built-in validation command that actually validates against the open API schema. So it's like, it's kind of forcing you towards a schema. And if it's using open API, then you can autogen docs for it and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But see, none of this shit and like API Star, Falcon, Flask, like you still... If you need to build, if you're building microservices that like are firewalled off in a private subnet that your app can talk to freely in an unauthenticated manner, you can do some crazy fast shit with API Star. But the second you need to open that up externally and I need token-based authentication and an auth system and I need to do like request throttling and stuff like that, I don't know that these frameworks give you what you can get with DRF. As far as like at that point, the speed curve of what you can get in the open source market, if you will, is enormous with DRF.
Yeah, that's and that's kind of my interest in Gin in Go is not just Gin the drink. Honestly, not much of an interest there.
I have a strong interest in Gin personally,
but. but
Bombay Sapphire, if you got it,
is under that same paradigm, though, that I would have that in a private network that can't talk to anything except probably a Django application or something right in front of that that handles authentication, and then just some microservices guy's doing. I remember, though, having the same cores issue as you have with DRF, that I had to go find some kind of cores library to plug into the thing.
Because, you know, that still blows my mind that, like, we have frameworks for building REST APIs that don't account for the fact
I
that...
I never intend for a browser to ever hit this microservice.
Well, right. I mean, or like the browser will hit it, but it's going to be hosted at the same domain, you know? Like, my JavaScript's not going to be served from S3 or CloudFront or some CDN. It's going to be served by the same domain name.
Yeah. Right?
'Cause cores isn't a problem if you're serving your API and your front end all from, you know, some really crappy setup like Nginx or you know, Django's run server. But the second you like set up a real production environment, it always explodes, and then I get really pissed off and go install the cores headers thing. And I'm gonna stop bitching about it now. Stop building API frameworks that don't handle cross-source and origin resource sharing.
Open it up and give me the responsibility of tightening it down after that.
I understand the format of like secure by default, and you have to override that. I bitched a little bit. I got a little annoyed one version of Django where view sets and basically not view sets, form factories and model forms and things like that all started requiring that you define either explicitly defining the fields that the form uses or defining excluding. It used to, you just made a model form and you pointed it at a model and you got a form and it was, everything was in it. And that now raises an exception. And basically it forces you to say, no, pick what fields you want. Because what would happen is you'd build a model form for some model. And it would, you'd get all the fields for that model.
Primary key and everything.
Yeah. Or maybe you'd exclude primary key or you wouldn't have one or something like that. But what would happen is like later, right? The bigger risk was later down the road, some other developer adds a field to the model. Doesn't even look at the UI or that particular UI or every form that's derived from that model. And suddenly you're exposing like some private data just by virtue of adding it to the model. It starts popping up in forms all over your web app. So I get why you default to security and like make people override it. So I don't mind the framework not enabling cores by default, but why the fuck do I have to install an external library? Yeah. Right. That's the problem. I'm okay with having to go into my settings file and configure it to say like, I'm sure that I'm okay with cores, you know, add the headers. But yeah, go to your package manager. This isn't Node.js. Okay. I don't want to go to my package manager to install like, you know, some rudimentary and core thing to API development to use it.
Like Express and just lean into middleware.
Yep.
Never.
So what's your Tyrell, like your what's your favorite API framework?
So I my default would be, you know, going with Django and DRF at this point.
I haven't looked
at the lighter stuff.
For me, that's because of my depth of knowledge there. Tinkering with the other stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't leaned heavily into building microservices yet. I just haven't had the free time or production requirements to lean into like really exploring that space. So, I mean, obviously, like it, the conversation changes when it's like this API is not exposed to a browser. It requires so much less. And so you want that to be like really light and fast versus like instantly when I think of, like my default APIs is in my mind, everything should be a JSON canon, like on the internet, like everything should just be an API realistically, I think to some degree or another. So in that sense, you just put whatever, you know, your backend, everything in a sense on the internet is just a CRUD app. It's just like, here, you wrap something pretty around my database.
Yep.
And so like the ability to exchange
web
information.
Web services just become a data access layer.
Right. Exactly. And so like, you should be able to, like, when things become standardized, the nice thing is that you can write your back end whatever you want. I don't care what framework, I don't care what language, any of that. Just authenticate well, spit out what I need, and then on, you know, my preferred side being on the back end is go write your front end in whatever JavaScript you love this month. Mm-hmm. That's fine. This is what my APIs will give you and accept from you. And this is how we get to be friends. Because if you get a wild hair in like 6 months and say, I'm going to rewrite the front end in Knockout.
Yep.
Then, sure. I don't care.
Knock yourself out.
I'm not paying your salary. If you can get management to approve that, I don't care. I'm not changing my API stuff.
And don't worry, we'll make sure that the back end actually makes sure that this product is foundational.
Yeah, exactly. And so those, like, in that sense, that's where the bulk of my API experience has been. And so in that sense, using more feature complete API tools like Rails or Django with DRF has really been where I've focused.
It's definitely why I've yet to build something in one of these other frameworks, aside from like my toy project with API Star.
Right.
And we did some things with AWS Chalice is really cool. Mm-hmm. It's very similar to Flask development, but it deploys like AWS Lambda functions. And so it's a serverless implementation of...
Makes that scary easy.
And deploying it.
The first time I did it, I was like, really? It's there?
It's as easy as like building and deploying an Elastic Beanstalk app, like platform as a service, except it stands up an API gateway and deploys every like route, if you will, of your API as an independent Lambda function. It's really slick. So that actually bears mentioning this conversation.
Yeah.
The benchmarks are meaningless at that point because it's infinite scale and it can literally handle a billion requests per second as long as your credit card can handle it when AWS sends you the bill.
Yeah, it's like Heroku. You just push button and empty wallet. You've got infinite scalability. You're fine there. Yeah. More dinos. Just throw more dinos at it.
Yeah, it has more scale than you have money for sure.
Exactly.
Unless you're Jeff Bezos. And then it's one-to-one.
Nice. Or your Johnny Salesforce. I forget his name.
Benioff. Yeah,
because Salesforce is owned by Heroku, which is a sad little interesting fact.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
When did that happen?
No, excuse me.
The other way
backwards.
Around. Yeah, Heroku is
owned by Salesforce.
I did not know that.
Yeah, they bought them a while back. So
that's too bad.
Interesting.
I guaranteed, well, maybe it's changing, but there weren't many Salesforce deployments running on Heroku for a long time or internal services.
No. Well, and now they push you towards that, like... When you're building new Salesforce stuff, they're just like, why don't you use this fancy little push button Heroku thingy to get going?
We've got a Heroku. What do they call them in Heroku? It's not platforms. Platforms is what Elastic Beanstalk calls them. But
dinos?
No. Dinos are the containers that run them. I forget now. Platforms, toolkits, toolchains, something like that.
Toolkit. I think you're right. I think it's toolkit.
Who uses toolkit?
Not in a long time.
But one thing that's interesting is like then you start having the debate about what do you break off to a microservice? What of your processes do you spin off to make a microservice and use that internal API for versus what do you do within your app itself? And that's kind of, I know that goes back to the heart of like making things like Rails and Django scale, which even takes me back even further, like the debates about like the MVC and what goes where? What's in your model? What's in your view? What's in your controller? And it's been like, I know that was pretty contentious. Like fat models, skinny views. Mm. Well, skinny controllers.
Yeah.
I think of is it Rail? I don't know if you guys would have known about Rails Envy, which is guy. I forget the guy's name offhand. He's a Rails developer, obviously, but he went on to found Code School, and he made this whole list of videos. There was a series called Rails Envy, and it was just like making fun of all the frameworks coming up that were very similar to Rails and how they were competing. And it was a spin off of the Mac versus PC commercials.
Oh, okay.
And so they did that, but then they did a series that was actually pretty informative and really weird. Which everything was informative and weird, but these were exceptionally so, and it was examining MVC patterns and they would talk about MVC patterns in these really goofy, weird videos. And it would always conclude with one of the guys making his, like this is the programming principle we want to impart to you. And he would be like, hi, I'm so-and-so, and I look like TV's Burt Reynolds because of my mustache, and that's why I'm an authority. And he would say things like, you always need to make sure your models are fat and that your controllers are lean. And it was like the most weird, random stuff, but it made that dude very successful. And Greg Paul, oh, Greg Pollock, I believe is his name.
Okay, yeah.
Something like that.
Does ring a bell.
Super sharp guy. But yeah, those were really old videos that were funny that kind of helped me retain the knowledge of just like where does my business logic go? Mm. What do I need to spin off? What do I need to put where? How do I keep this as streamlined as possible so that I don't end up backing up services or backing up function calls and bogging things down. And so that's kind of like the predecessor to the what can I make a microservice conversation.
I really could have used some sort of mnemonic device like that when I was when I was working on Ember stuff. Mm. Except you'd have to have a cast of 85 people come out.
There's a lot of components there.
How's it going? I'm I'm a route action. And I'm just a route, and I'm a component action.
It's like Sesame Street at that point. Yeah, yeah.
And I'm a component template.
Ember Street.
You'll need to use all 16 of us in tandem to render words to the screen in this order. That's I'm gonna have to look those up. That sounds fun.
Yeah, they're a lot of fun. New. It's one of the things. It was one of the only MVC framework that they gave much props to besides Rails was Django. Of course, they called it DJ Ango, and he was just like, "I'm DJ Ango."
it was
pretty obnoxious.
So doing it, they did it fun.
Yeah. Oh yeah,
I still get recruiter calls and stuff, which is annoying in and of its own. But then I get recruiter calls that are like, "We're looking for a Django developer."
Mm. No, you're not.
Yeah.
Or you're not going to find one.
They're like, we can't find them anywhere. I'm like, oh, fuck. I wonder why that is.
You don't have a Django developer.
That's super weird. I've never met a Django developer either.
Yeah, me neither.
Fun fact, I went to DjangoCon in Portland, 2013, 2014, one of those years, and got to the hotel, and I was checking in, and I gave the clerk at the hotel my driver's license as part of the check-in process. And they're like, oh, you're here for the conference? And I said, yeah. And she said, she started a conversation because she said, we had someone else from Arkansas in here, which was apparently a spectacle for someone in Portland, Oregon to be like, there's two of them.
And they got shoes on.
And she was like, oh, two people from Arkansas. And you're at this Django conference. That's interesting. There's a lot of people coming for this conference. And I said, yeah, it's a cool thing. It moves around all the time. And she said, so is that is that about the movie? And I was like, oh no. It's a computer thing. And yeah. She was like, oh, I thought you guys really liked, what's his name? Jamie Foxx, And I was like, no, not the movie.
Which even come to find out, that's a remake.
Yes. I found that out after seeing the movie, too.
I did, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They, reprised the theme song from the original movie, yep. Right?
They did.
We're talking about... I'm filling Tyrell in. Yeah. Who never left.
No.
He was here the whole time.
He's been here the whole time.
Please tell me what I just heard.
Yeah. You were just hearing... we were talking about the Django Unchained, the movie.
Oh, yeah.
It was actually a remake.
Yeah.
It was...
There's an original Django.
Oh, yes.
From the 70s.
That was not a bloodbath.
It was a bloodbath.
Yeah, but it wasn't a...
He carries a Gatling gun in a coffin that is chained to him that he carries about.
I guess I probably...
Drags
probably
about,
relative to other films in the 70s, it was a bloodbath.
Yeah.
Still wasn't a Quentin Tarantino bloodbath.
No, but that I think that was his homage to the original.
That's what inspired him, maybe.
Yeah.
Speaking of bloodbaths... It's time for our weekly Why in JavaScript segment.
What'd you find?
Brain.js, implementing neural networks
in JavaScript. What I've always wanted to do. Yeah. Because JavaScript is so easily applied to a GPU.
Why ever touch a server?
Mm.
Why not do it all in a browser.
We're going to do...
My browser is a server.
We're going to do an image classification neural network. We're going to roll it out company-wide. Everyone open your browser JavaScript console and paste this code in there. NPM install the entirety of mankind's written knowledge and implement a neural network. You know, I was thinking about... this is going to trigger you, Ty, and I apologize in advance.
But all right, here we go.
But we're talking about standardizing everything on the web should be JSON canons.
Yes.
Now on this subject, tell me how you feel about
WebSockets.
APIs implemented over WebSockets.
Yeah, I don't much care for them yet, but I'm pretty sure this is part of what makes me like the old man of the future in the present.
Oh, you're an elder millennial too. Oh, we discovered that last week.
We've come back. I consider myself a baby Xer, but that's just because
you're just being generous.
Yeah. We'll see. But yeah, I've had the joy of working in APIs that are WebSocket only, and they don't want you to use a REST API. Mm-mm. And they say, well, test this in your browser.
Yeah, like you, were
you
reading,
can't use Postman.
You were reading the docs and it was like, open up the JavaScript console.
Open up the JavaScript console, your browser, and put this code in there. And then when you're feeling like a real boy, do this in Node. And I was befuddled. Like, why? What is happening with the world that everything needs a WebSocket? And I'm quite aware that will become more common, and it brings me great terror.
I told him not to. I was like, don't do it in Node. Just like run headless Chrome and then use like a Python Selenium driver to be your backend API. That's the plan.
Well, I mean, I'm using WebSocket, the WebSocket clients.
So you can do it in Python.
So I'm doing it in Python. I'm not going to.
But like, you're not even getting this API is not even implementing real time data. You're fetching historical data on demand. You're pulling. It's not pushing.
Correct.
And it's over a WebSocket.
Correct. But that's in their defense, I guess. That's not why they built this API. Hmm. Like I'm kind of trying to clandestinely. Why
would you clandestinely?
Would it be clandestinely? Mm-hmm. I'm trying to extract data from a system. That's,
someone call Chad. Chad, if you're listening,
we need the etymology.
Oh, we need Chad on the podcast now.
Well, that's
happening.
I hadn't thought about that yet.
I got so excited. How has it taken us this many episodes to realize Chad needs to be on this podcast?
Chad, if you're listening, show up at our office in like 4 hours because the episode will come out and you'll hear this, and in like 4 hours we'll be recording in. Yeah, we'll see you.
We'll
see you in 4 hours.
Yep, we'll see you then, man. Mm-hmm. No, so I am extracting data from a platform that has basically considered itself the terminus of your data. Like, why would you ever take your data out of here? You would leave your data here. So manipulate your data with WebSockets to your heart's content, because you don't ever need to get it out. And if you do, here's like this one method way back here to get it out as a CSV. But you have to do that with WebSockets.
Pull your 17.
Can I have a Git? No, there's not a Git. Okay.
We'll open up a connection. N-dimensional data in a two-dimensional format.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, so that's the world I'm in right now, and it's bleak, but it is the future.
I hope not.
I'm
still chalking that up to some technical debt somewhere.
I feel like I'm like the digital Cormac McCarthy these days. I just see doom and gloom everywhere in the future. I'm going to be riding like the road, but for web development.
Oh, man. That is a gloomy story, for sure.
All over. I told you it was going to trigger him. I knew it would.
It puts me in that mood.
I'm not as close to it because I didn't have to do it, but it bothered me hearing it. I feel bad that you're having to live in that.
I apologize that you had to hear it so much. I have a tendency when I get triggered to flail a bit. and so everyone knows like the current frustration I'm facing in the office.
I don't think that there's anyone on the dev team here that doesn't do that.
Yeah.
I think that's normal. Is that normal? Is everyone
it's
developer?
Normal for me,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, I think, yeah.
I would think so.
Is it part of the mindset of being like a logic like my world's in logic all day. Mm. And so when something unexpected and seemingly completely illogical happens, we just like start convulsing.
I think for me, we have to have someone else validate this. Yeah. This illogic is what it is.
Yeah. No, you know? It's to me, 9 times out of 10, it's me going, am I the dumb one? Because I'm pretty sure I'm not, but this makes me feel like the dumb one.
I've got to be
someone
dumb.
Else. Please confirm that I'm not the dumb one.
Yeah.
Cause there's like, this is,
or at least be thing. Dumb with me.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I don't want to be dumb in isolation. Please don't make me the only dumb one.
Fortunately, we have a very good sort of like tribalism confirmation bias echo chamber within the office. We're like, no, that's fucking retarded.
That's exactly.
No way.
It is an echo chamber.
And then we decided that echo chamber was too closed off, so we started a podcast to foist it upon you.
Mm-hmm.
So go out there and tell everyone how much you hate WebSocket-based APIs.
Yeah.
They're terrible.
It's not what WebSockets is for.
And they'll lead to the downfall of Western civilization.
That's where it starts.
Yeah.
Well, that's like the next evolution of JavaScript everything. Because I guarantee you,
I'm trying,
information out of that neural network from BrainJS, got a WebSocket.
I'm trying really hard not to imagine the next evolution of JavaScript. I don't want to think about that.
Well, I mean, it already.
I don't want to know where that's going. It's like thinking about the next evolution of nuclear war. Like that's just. Well, I'm not into it. You know.
You know. I mean, it left the browser. So where else can it go? Anywhere.
I know. It felt like a virus or a bug.
I can't wait till JavaScript is in pacemakers.
God,
that's I give it 5 years till somebody on Hacker News is just like, bro, I run my pacemaker out JavaScript.
You
know what?
I'm
not kidding.
You made a joke about the decline of Western civilization, but it's true. When some express server is reconciling credit card transactions and Visa falls over because someone installed LeftPad.
Yeah, exactly.
And the dream of the narrator at the end of Fight Club is achieved, but it's because of a shitty dependency malfunction and the build system has atrophied and therefore the financial markets crash. Oh, that's a terrible thought.
Yeah.
The road.
That's why we still run in COBOL.
I was going to say, that's why we still have the AS. That's why there's AS400s and SEAL Team 6 of the Eldra Gen X programmers are still out there making the world work.
AS400s. Did you just say that?
Yeah.
From They Who Shall Not Be Named, where I was once employed, we got to deal with those. So we had one small little abstraction layer upon the AS400 database that was, everyone called it green screen because it was
a green, it wasn't even an amber display.
It ran in your two color
green display.
Yeah. And it ran in your console on your Windows machine. And I see. You look at like the copyright on it, 1986 or something.
That's
like,
fantastic.
They're like, it works. Never change it.
We do not touch the legacy code.
Mm-mm. Mm-mm. We in fact hire COBOL cowboys and stuff, and AS400 experts to maintain it. God, just let it live. here's money. Yeah. Just make it keep working.
We pay them 25% of our deposits to retain them just to keep the bank afloat.
Yeah.
Yeah. I knew some people. I don't keep up with anyone these days, but I knew some people when I was down in Central Arkansas that were COBOL and Fortran developers, specifically in finance. And truth, like, they just wrote their own checks, named what they wanted. These people were working from home.
I mean,
like before working from home was working from home. These people were working from home in the early 90s, and they were the only people on earth that had that ability at all. And it wasn't even like we didn't even have the telephony and communication systems for them to actually work at home effectively.
Yeah.
They were just like, you can do that or you can go fuck yourself. I'm working from home.
They just roll in with like a... the 3.5 floppy.
Yeah.
Put that code back.
Five inch floppy. Yeah. You know? Yeah. It was like full on office
space.
Fire up
their Windows 95 machine. And
So Fortran's still a thing.
It is.
It's come back around.
Mm.
Fortran, it's not under Python 3, but Fortran was a dependency of the Python 2 version of SciPy or scikit-learn, one or the other.
One of those.
So Mondabrain.
Yeah.
One of our projects we work on had Fortran as a dependency. We had to like for a while, we had to get Fortran installed on all the machines, which was like just blowing my mind that that was a thing. But people were still doing
remarkable,
it.
Yeah.
People are still doing it. I worked on a project at PBS, and there was a developer there. He didn't make it very long.
God rest his soul.
Yeah. Well, he's still alive. He didn't last on that particular project. He was tasked with, so this was before AWS had any sort of like Elasticsearch as a service kind of offering. So they had this thing called Cloud Search. You guys remember that? Mm-hmm. AWS Cloud Search?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It was basically AWS hosted Solr. Mm. And so we were trying to build a Cloud Search backend for Haystack. Haystack was this search pluggable app for Django. Basically, like you could annotate a Django model and it would index it into pluggable search backends, just like you can switch databases, you could switch search backends. So they had Solr support, but not AWS Cloud Search. And so he was going to write his own backend for Haystack for Cloud Search. And
mighty noble.
It was. And he took this on, and it was like 6 weeks into it, and he didn't have an update. And finally, like, what's going on? He's like, well, I'm having a really hard time installing Fortran. And the project manager was like, that's it. You were out. But yeah, apparently, 6 weeks
to get the dev environment working.
I don't remember exactly the reason for Fortran, but yeah, that was part of it. It was like, oh, you gotta use Fortran for this portion of it. And I was like, pretty sure you don't. You're just making web requests to an API. It's not even in WebSockets. This was back before we had murdered the internet with WebSocket APIs.
That's true.
Yeah,
the good old days.
Nostalgia.
All you needed was JavaScript was in the browser.
All you needed was a little HTML.
Yep. Before JavaScript became airborne.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Back when, every page was a custom HTML document that you wrote yourself.
Mm-hmm. PHP labor of love.
Made sense.
Yeah.
PHP made sense for a while.
It did coming from that. Where you made every page from. Yeah.
Just like, I just want this little piece of my HTML to be dynamic.
Exactly.
Yep. Yep. That was perfect.
I want this part to talk to the server.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It was like, it was a better implementation of server-side includes.
Remember
SSI from from IIS and that sort of stuff?
Mm-hmm. Oof. Now we're talking. Now I was going to make, what's web? Web forms, old ASP.
Oh yeah.
One of the first web things I ever touched was a .NET Nuke site.
Mm. Oh yeah.
And it was horrendous. Mm.
We worked at a newspaper where we cranked out the website in its entirety every morning when we took what went to print in the at midnight.
You would basically print the website every night.
Yeah, exactly. We would generate a new index.html. It just generated flat HTML files, and we'd FTP them over and hit yes, overwrite anything that's the same and cross our fingers and hope for the best. Mm-hmm. And it was all written in FileMaker Pro.
Nice.
Yeah. We gave it a big dump of XML that we would yank out of.
Big dump, all right.
big old dump that we would yank out of what was before InDesign? Adobe PageMaker.
Yeah.
And then slap it into FileMaker, and it was like, here's 3,000 HTML files and images. And then we'd use like...
They all reference each other correctly. Just trust me.
And it had a bunch of SSI in it.
Mm.
Or what was the other thing? EdgeSide Includes? Was that a thing? I don't remember what it was. Yeah.
Now you've made me think of... Now that we're talking about like this old stuff...
We can't have an episode of this podcast where we don't reminisce about the good old days.
Mm.
You know what? I never dip my toes into, and I it's still black magic to me. It's Flash.
Oh, ActionScript Flash 2 and 3.
Flash is just like ooh.
What was that shit that was like derivative? It was Adobe. It was like ActionScript based, but they built like a framework around it. It was like it had a lot of. It was like this weird amalgam of Flash. An action script and like something like jQuery.
And like fireworks or whatever was it?
Fireworks, no. Fireworks would compile down to just Shockwave files.
Okay.
So you would like author interactive experiences. No, it was this whole web framework. I'm never going to remember what it was, but It was interesting. Yeah, I did a lot of Flash action script too.
Oh, really?
I worked in advertising, so if any ad that wasn't a static image was a Flash banner. Remember,
yeah.
Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
That's not a thing anymore. But like, remember ads that would come out of their hole, you know?
Make sure you saw them.
You have like an ad at the top of the page and it would fucking like crawl down the page over the top of what you were doing. That was all in Flash, and I built those. And we did it with a bunch of ActionScript. We would have like, there was this really rudimentary communication layer where basically like in IE was an ActiveX control. In other browsers, there was some interface that JavaScript could access that would basically put state in a place where ActionScript could find it. So you had this really rudimentary, like basically name a variable and put it out there. And in your Flash file, you could access that variable. So you could pass information in and out of it, not dynamically as much in real time, but some actions and stuff. So like our ad server would deliver a chunk of HTML with a Flash, like a Shockwave file, and then like a little payload of JavaScript that would give it some state and tell it like how to interact and what would happen when people clicked on certain things.
Interesting.
Hmm. Yeah. It was ugly though.
Yeah.
And I can't even imagine like game development stuff.
Yeah.
Like remember, Flash games were the shit.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Homestar Runner and Emo Game.
Did you ever
.com come to mind?
Did you ever do any Flash animation?
No. I didn't touch Flash at all. It was always like, ooh.
Flash animation was kind of cool. It was like, you know, it was all based on tweening and keyframing. Kind of like still a lot of 3D animation is. You render some things and move it from here to there. And you'd say, I'd like to, you know, tween across 30 frames, moving from there to there. And either you want it linear or you want it curved or, you know, pick and it would animate the points in between.
Right.
And you could do all that. And then you could control and interact with that with ActionScript. You could make, instead of tween frame 30 being hard coded, that was an ActionScript variable that you could change when a user clicked on a button or pushed a key or something like that. And so you built these little scenes and vignettes that you could then control with ActionScript.
But yeah.
The animation side was actually a lot of fun.
Yeah. The closest I've ever come to that was probably when I was doing some iOS development and like some of the older ways that you interacted.
I would imagine it's similar.
You built the UI within an iOS app. And I've had minimal iOS development experience.
It reminded me a lot.
Out there, but not a lot.
Like if you've ever done like Maya 3D or Bryce 3D with Repop. I was a Mac kid, as you can tell.
Yeah.
Talking about Flash and PageMaker and all that stuff. But
all Blender.
See, I never used Blender. Yeah. But it was similar.
That's
to
how
that.
I got into Python.
Oh, that's right. You can script Blender with Python.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh. Blender's written in Python.
Now that blows my mind. Mm. It must be really slow rendering.
Yeah, it is. I back then, I don't know if it was just my machine or not, but you know, it's interesting. Like you click on, I was on a Windows machine, you click the Blender icon, right? And it pulls up a terminal just for a split second, runs that Python script that fires up Blender.
And which is like Qt or some framework.
Probably,
have you guys ever used, you know, there's actually a windowing toolkit built into Python in the standard library.
Really?
I forget what it's called. TK Enter?
It's called I Want to Hang Myself from
I
the
think
rafter.
It's called TK Enter is what it's called. Brutal.
That's the name of the podcast.
we got a title, everybody. Yeah. We can go home.
Yeah, TK Enter.
TK Enter.
Yeah.
I've never used it, but you can build like GUI stuff that's relatively cross-platform.
That seems like a miserable idea.
Never had a reason to build a GUI in Python.
Yeah.
Not yet.
Mm. I played with a Ruby GUI tool for game design briefly.
Mm.
And I made my 8-bit emoji face like move around the screen based on like key entry and stuff.
While we're on the subject, sorry Tyrell if I interrupted you.
I'm done.
Okay. I didn't mean to. I'm gonna like, yeah, bam, there, look at that in Slack.
Oh, what you got? My computer's asleep.
Oh no. Wake it up. It happened to me at the DMV the other day. My foot went to sleep, and I was like, oh, no, they're going to call my number. I'm going to warm this thing up. Oh, I won't be able to stand up.
I thought you were, like, talking about your computer at the DMV.
They got good Wi-Fi there.
Beware. This is, what's his name's company?
Yep.
A guy. No,
he's got a name.
Oh,
that
guy.
No, he's Australian.
Yeah, he's president of the Django Software Foundation for a long time.
Russell Keith McGee.
Yeah, Dr. Russell Keith McGee. Yeah, he gave a.
He didn't always put that in the trademark on the bottom of his page.
He always introduces himself in all of his talks. I've seen he's at every PyCon, DjangoCon. Usually has a couple of talks. Super cool dude.
Yeah, so I think I did one of these tutorials.
I saw him give a lightning talk on this. Yeah,
I did too. Not in person, but I watched the.
I don't remember if it was in person or not.
I watched the YouTube, rendition thereof. But it's interesting. It's an interesting idea.
So we to be clear, we're talking about something called Toga.
Oh yeah,
a Python native OS native GUI. Toolkit,
which is part of the Beware project, which is like a set of tools for developers.
Just go to the show notes; it'll make more sense.
Yeah, it's kind of like the idea is like a React Native, but in Python.
Mm.
So it's write Python code, deploy it to anything.
Get native GUI for desktop.
Yep.
PyB.py.
Your Android, iOS.
Oh really? It goes mobile.
That's cool.
Yes.
Finally, we can, as Python developers, be like, put Python everywhere. Deal with it.
Mm.
It's like JavaScript's done to us.
Yeah.
Apple has not given us the ability to run the Python framework on mobile, and it's really lame.
Yeah, I've done that with, was it QPython? I think that you can get for Android that gives you a console.
Yeah, and, there's something like
that.
IDE,
it's a text editor.
But, the one that I'm thinking of that you can run on iOS is like an encapsulated app. You open the app, and from there you can do Python. You can script with it and like tool around, but it's a science fair project. As far as like deploying an app, that uses like Python interpreter and nothing.
Well, yeah, and he does that. Oh, I was going to say from the last part of this, it's saying like that it doesn't yet work on mobile, but it aims to correct this.
PyBee.org, PyBee.org.
Just need, Android and Swift developers out there to plug Python into that API.
Yep.
So.
Well, I think that's an episode. Good stuff on the API. And, we called Tom Christie out, and Tom's a big listener of the show, as you guys both know.
We love you, Tom.
Tom, since you're listening, let us know. Is that the plan? Are you putting REST framework on the shelf?
Just text me next time you get a minute.
Yeah. Or just stop by.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Well, we'll see you in a week.
Thanks for listening to Friday Afternoon Deploy, recorded and produced by the team at Lofty Labs. If you enjoyed the show, you can subscribe to future episodes via iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. You can also follow at Friday Deploy on Facebook and Twitter for episode previews, live streams, and other behind-the-scenes peeks. Past episodes and show notes on this episode can be found at friday.hirelofty.com. That's friday.hirelofty.com. If you'd like to contact the show, or if you're local to the Northwest Arkansas area and would like to be a guest on the show, you can email us at podcast@hirelofty.com.